stuff I'm going to show you is basically results of Planck collaboration, and I joined Planck after the first release. So spent like basically 2 years or so studying on the maps, preparing for the 2015 release, which was the one which delivered the polarization. Now, this story is still evolving, as you know that there is a next release planning up with the improved data analysis coming up potentially this late this summer. So I'll have nothing to say about that one except keep essentially your eyes open for it. What I want to talk about is basically talk about the mission very briefly. You probably heard a lot of talks about it in one way or another on the conferences. And I will spend a little bit more time on foregrounds and CMB separation from foregrounds. For a theory, cosmologies, this is sort of novel topic that there is actually other stuff rather than like CMB on the sky. And it turns out to be probably rather important, maybe critically important thing if you want to do fundamental cosmology, because if you want to go after B-modes, you will have no choices to understand the dirty stuff around you. And I will talk a little bit about the B-modes and the dust story. And after I give the standard speech about the implication for inflation, I will have a little bit more fun time and talk about the anomalies in the data. A lot of them are basically 2 sigma level, but some of them are very interesting. Essentially highlight a few tests of the isotropy and statistics of the CMB, which we have been doing for Planck. There is a lot of them. If you want to know full glorious details, go to isotropy and statistics paper and grind through all like 60 glorious pages of it. And that was a highly condensed version from actual like, you know, working group meetings. Anyway, here is an instrument that's before the launch. It's essentially a satellite which has two kind of detectors inside. One's are bolometer based, the other ones are radio frequency based. So if you go in the if you go into the focal plane, I'll go in there. There is a bunch of stuff horns there under the primary mirror. And the reason for that is you want to have many frequency channels so you can get the component separations right. Okay. So that was before the launch. The first data release happened in 2013. So what's new in the 2015 is basically more data. The entire mission data set has been analyzed and it's been better processed. So polarization data set is being worked on right now in the further improvement of the processing techniques. So there will be still, you know, more improved polarization maps made available. So here's the focal plane of it. It's full of horns. Horns feed radio frequency, or rather microwave frequency waves going into the detector. And if you go into the detector plane, it looks like this schematically. There is a bunch of detectors in there. All this thing rotates and basically scans the sky. And you have a bunch of channels ranging from reasonably low frequencies, 30 gigahertz type channels, to high frequency ones, 857 gigahertz or so. So if you remember your black body radiation spectrum, 2.7 Kelvin peaks out at about 100 gigahertz, give or take 10 gigahertz. I think it's like take 10 gigahertz away. So that basically would say that if you actually want to go for the maximal density of the CMB, you should just observe 100 gigahertz and you'll be happy and live ever after. Unfortunately, there is other stuff you're looking at. And CMB is far away from you, so but the stuff you're looking in front is like having like, you know, extremely dirty mirror being like, you know, shined on by other stuff around you. So it is critical if you want to do cosmology to get rid of that stuff, and it's just as critical if you want to do other stuff to get rid of that cosmological pesky background known as CMB. If you want to do cool dust map, you don't want CIB or CMB backgrounds in it. So what you want is you want to know what the stuff is that you're looking at. The way you do it is, well, you could use morphological information about it, how it looks like on the sky. CMB is a Gaussian random noise. It's not done like that at all now. Maybe it will be in the future. But what you do to do the discrimination between the different signal is frequency coverage in essentially radio band frequency. So here's the intensity of stuff depending on the frequency in gigahertz on this axis for different things you're looking at on the sky. CMB is this cyan pale line. And this is essentially normalized to temperature units, so it is tilted compared to the usual black body spectrum. So the highest power for CMB, you go around about maybe 90 gigahertz band. But there is a lot of other stuff on the sky, and it is coming from the places not too far away from us. It's not cosmological stuff, not necessarily. A lot of the stuff is associated with our own galaxy. There is a lot of dust in the universe, and it's not just, you know, household dust. It's various interesting kind of dust around you. And two main things that comes in and spoil you fun at different frequencies is thermal dust and spinning dust components. And there is also synchrotron, which is a power law, which happens because there are free electrons going around in magnetic fields, and you get just synchrotron radiation coming at you. So those things are essentially local to us. It's our galaxy. CMB is, oh yes, and I forgot, there is also free emission. That's when electrons basically scatter and do Bremsstrahlung. There is basically a lot of stuff which is local to us or not too far away at cosmological distances. And you're trying to make out the CMB out from these foregrounds. So if you sum up all the foregrounds, they actually sort of exceed the CMB in pretty much all the bands. There is a notch around 100 to 70 gigahertz where you probably want to go if you want to have this clean CMB picture. So you can design your experiment to go and go after that notch, but if you want to actually know what you're looking at, you're better off to essentially have as wide frequency coverage as possible. Situation becomes even worse if you want to do polarization, because a lot of that stuff is highly polarized. Synchrotron is for sure polarized, because stuff goes around on a circle, it has a plane. And thermal dust is also has polarized emission and turned out to be rather more polarized than people were thinking. It could be as, like, you know, basically 20% polarization fraction. Now, in this situation, you're essentially looking at the CMB signal for polarization, even in E-mode, like polarization, the one you just want to do it. It is actually subdominant to foreground, so you have to be extracting this and extracting this cleanly. Now, if you want to go for something like a glorious B-mode detection, then nobody quite knows the amplitude at which the B modes are. If you have R, which is, like, you know, reasonably large, like 0.1, then these guys are quite a bit lower than E modes. That basically means you'd have to do your background to foreground separation at least, like, you know, by a factor of, like, you know, 10 better than just getting E modes. Now that becomes essentially a problem about the dust. Now, okay, so one of the things why you want to do this from space is, unfortunately, although the space experiments are hard to design, like, you know, takes a long time to fly and are rather expensive, atmosphere has also lots of stuff in it. And if you're looking through it, you actually are cutting out a lot of stuff you want to see. Water vapor absorbs and microwave frequencies. Essentially, if you have even tiny amount of water, not like, you know, BC, Vancouver type, or like, you know, Ontario type of water in the atmosphere, you are cutting out most of the stuff about 400 gigahertz. It's just not transparent. So this is plot shading showing the absorption ratios for different levels of water pressure. Half a millimeter or 1 millimeter of pressure of water vapor, this is as dry as it gets basically on Earth if you go to South Pole or like very high in the like Chile desert, there would be a few millimeters of water pressure and it might fluctuate on you. So then you would be dealing with sort of, you know, time variable absorption ratio, which is probably not fun to do processing at. So people who do it from the ground, you go for the windows of visibility. There is one prominent one here and here. So you see, this is basically 100 gigahertz, it's like 150 gigahertz. So if you go from the ground and want to nail CMB, you basically go on those two bands and you go with many detectors and you nail them. There is a lot of experiments that do it like that at the South Pole. Bicep and Keck array is designed like that. Unfortunately, it's very hard to get to the higher frequency because of this. And essentially, this basically means that dust discrimination in this type of setup is not that great. So with this said, so let's come back to Planck and talk about how Planck does component separation. There is essentially four different component separation and CMB cleaning methods. They are done essentially by entirely different pipeline, and you can compare the maps coming out from them. And that way you have basically reasonable control on the quality of the different kind of separation methods. You can literally examine the residuals between the maps and see what is different between them. So three of these guys, like SMICA 7 and NILK, are essentially harmonic based. SMICA, for example, is just a sort of linear combination of stuff with coefficients varying on L in different frequencies. So coefficients have been selected to minimize the RMS of other stuff leaking the CMB. And there is one explicit, essentially, per pixel likelihood pipeline known as Commander. So all of this are cross-checked, and they're cross-checked again the simulations of the perfectly, like, you know, random Gaussian sky. When you try to, like, you know, derive confidence of things, like, you know, from CMB, you basically compare to a stack of simulations. Yes.
You said you only use the frequency dependence to separate, or because
there is some templating thrown in for other things. For most of the methods, you just use frequency weights.
Because then, don't you need to know the spectrum well, and maybe the spectrum varies,
say yes.
Synchrotron in the sky and things like that.
Yes. This is especially big problem if you go after and extrapolate the dust spectrum. Nobody knows what it's doing. In fact, look for the upcoming intermediate Planck paper. If it's not out yet, it's going to be momentarily. This does exactly this. What happens to the sky if the spatial, there are spatial variation of the spectral index in frequency? Yes. So this is, you know, this, some of that stuff is model dependent, especially, like, you know, one of the big deals is what is the statistical properties of dust and how can we characterize them. The war on that, like, essentially that much known about polarization properties of the dust before Planck flew and did the full sky maps of it. The reason is, of course, you cannot see it from the ground that well. Anyway, so if you go out and look at the maps of the components, there is quite a few of these things. And as if you're interested in cosmology, you're pretty much interested in the CMB one. But there is also a lot of other components that's thrown in. So what I'm showing you is basically a stack of all the components in the component separation pipeline. So you basically have CMB component, that's in temperature, and synchrotron and free-free emission, spinning dust, various CO lines, and I think anomalous residual in there. I forgot what this one is. Okay, so as you can see, these guys are all in a galactic coordinate projection, the small weight projection. Think about it of cutting up an orange and just unpeeling the peel, so it's like twice as long in one direction than another one. And the galaxy plane is a straight line, horizontal one, across it. So as you can see, a lot of these components have very prominent stuff, very bright in the galactic plane. But there is also spurs coming up and coming up to very high galactic latitudes. That's our own stuff around us, and we see it. And also, if you look closely at the temperature maps, CMB has a noticeable line coming at it at the galaxy. So no matter how good your cleaning is, there is still residual in the galactic plane. So you use masks a lot to try to get rid of the places where you suspect your component separation is not doing well. Okay. So for polarization, you do the same thing, and you worry about four grounds. Two main ones are synchrotron emission and thermal dust. And unlike the temperature, amplitude of CB polarization is less than four grounds. And dust emission turned out to be highly polarized. Polarization fraction is basically up to 20%, which is substantially more than, like, you know, a few percent people saw before, which makes your life interesting but also hard. Anyway. This is how polarization looks like, and that map of synchrotron polarization, total polarization amplitude, that's the sum of Q and U squared, 30 gigahertz. This is essentially, if you look at the 30 gigahertz, it's pretty much the proxy of the synchrotron. It's dominant by the synchrotron. You don't have to do component separation. If you look at it, you just have the synchrotron map, essentially. There is galactic stuff, and you notice that there is a lot of stuff coming out, especially the Z1. And I guess I will revert to the baryonic pointer so that I don't have to go. So and there is a lot of stuff coming up to high galactic latitude. That spur is, you know, prominent feature in a lot of maps. And interestingly enough, of course, synchrotron has to do with magnetic fields. Interestingly enough, if you look at the polarization direction, it is aligned with the structures you see. And that's not random. There is probably something going on with morphology. And the best way to visualize polarization direction, which is a headless sort of, you know, vector, it's a stick, is just to smear the map with random noise in the direction of the that, you know, that polarization. And that's what's done here. Essentially, you have the colors which represent the total intensity, and you have the smeared pattern, which is basically random noise smeared in the direction of polarization. And that tells you essentially where the structure of the magnetic field is around us when you look at the galaxy. So notice how long the correlation length is in the directions. It essentially goes like, you know, halfway across the sky. It's, you know, big magnetic field things happening around us. Okay, so that was synchrotron. It is fairly like, you know, correlated with magnetic field because we all know how synchrotron works. That's how dust polarization looks like. It's the same thing. It's total polarization amplitude at 353 gigahertz now, where you're dominated by the dust. And it's also smoothed a little bit to get rid of the noise. And you see the galaxy, and you still see the same spur coming up. Now, if you're going for the South Pole experiment, you're basically looking high latitude patches somewhere around here in the southern galactic hemisphere. And that is much less dusty than our galaxy plane, but it's not quite dust free. It was the hope that there would be some sort of, you know, dust free window around us where you can just stare at and see the primordial thing. It looks like no such luck. It's actually fairly dusty all the way around us. Okay, and you also see quite again very large correlated structures going, once again, in the same directions, extending with a very large correlation length. This basically tells you the polarization of the dust also traces magnetic field somehow. So physics of this is actually not quite clear at the, like, you know, not quite clear at the moment. It's probably is complicated. So one of the fun things I've been doing a lot is looking at the statistical properties of the dust maps and if there is some sort of astrophysical modeling of the dust properties that can be extracted. This is, of course, very non-Gaussian map. So if you, like, you know, used to thinking about the CMB as being Gaussian, noise and spectrum is completely, like, you describe the entire story. Well, that's the end of that. There will be sort of, you know, readjustments in the mental picture that needs to be made because it's obviously not isotropic, and it's also not Gaussian. Okay, so let's go back to the CMB. So if you extract CMB intensity map, it looks like this. So galaxy plane on it is actually not very obvious, but once again, as I said, for a lot of the analysis, people do mask all the suspicious regions, and you do check that the results do not depend on the cut on the mask you place, so you make sure that these things are robust. And here are the polarization maps. These ones are actually basically raw Q and U components. The only thing that has been done to them is they're smoothed, so you don't see the noise so much on pixel level. And the galaxy wasn't painted with a Gaussian random realization, so it does not visually, like, you know, distract you from the rest of the stuff. So current version of the maps is high-pass filtered for polarization, so you have basically zero power to L equal 20, and then it goes as basically cosine rising up to 1 at L equal 40. This is done so that the series do not write like a million of papers by looking at the residuals of stuff at L equal 20, because there is still known residuals at sub-microkelvin level in polarization maps. And they have to do essentially with scanning, dipole, and nonlinear ADC conversion. This is the stuff you probably don't want to know if you want to do, like, you know, CMB theory. So wait for that. The current maps will go out without this. Systematic has been mostly removed. All right. So the simplest thing you can do with these maps, and apart from taking a spectrum, is to take a look at the stacks of the places on the maps. So this is done in astronomy all the time. If you go after, like, you know, let's say, Sinev-Seldovich clusters, you would get all of them, you would stack of them, and then you get a picture of an average cluster. You can do this with CMB, and this has been done with WMAP, so this picture has been popularized by Komatsu's paper. For CMB, you would think that this is, like, you know, not particularly different from taking a spectrum thing. It's two-point function, right? So it should be just Fourier transform of a spectrum. Not so much if you're talking about things which potentially have contamination from non-Gaussian signals. So taking the stacks is a very good thing to do if you have non-Gaussian signals. You will understand them better, because a lot of the non-Gaussianity has local, like local real space correlations as opposed to like Fourier things. So that's the stack of the temperature on the high spots of the temperature. That's the stack of the temperature map on coldest of the temperature. They should be inverse of one another, and they are. And resolution here, it's basically this beam is smooth to 15 arc minutes full width half max. Essentially, there is no noise. You can make out just a residual amount of noise in the ring. The standard structure is you have a peak, and then there is a ringing down pattern, which has to do with essentially plasma, CMB plasma sloshing around. And that's essentially like another tracer of baryon acoustic oscillations, if you want. Now, these two things should be in a perfect world, negative of one another, and they are. So looking at the statistics, you know the field, you Gaussian random field you extracted them from, you can do quantitative tests whether this is actually Gaussian random field you thought it was or not. Now, this is easy with temperature, and this has been done. It's particularly easy to do with polarization as well. If you remember the WMAP picture, it was not quite as pretty. So here is the same thing stacked for polarization channel on hot spots and cold spots. What I'm stacking here is not the Q channel, but rather the polarization in the radial and tangential directions. So this is known essentially basically as Q in the rotated frame. The way you do it is, the reason you do it is, of course, so that you get use of the rotational symmetry around your peak, and then you get the same ring pattern around on the sky around the hot and cold spots. Now, just to say how far we have gotten in the last few years, this is a reminder, flashback to the 2009 paper of WMAP 7, I think it was 2009, where temperature, hot spots, and cold spots look like this, and Q and rotated and looked like kind of this. So if you draw a lot of lines on it, you sort of can make it out. And nowadays, it looks like this, and that's essentially real data. So data in polarization has come a long way. So there is also quite a bit lower noise. So essentially, there is very little noise on the scales you're looking at. Now, so this, of course, gets converted into the power spectrum. And that's where you do a lot of effort to make sure that all the residual, like, you know, systematics went away on you. And that's how you do likelihood with cosmological parameters. Here is a picture of the TT power spectrum with insert showing the difference between the baseline, like, you know, best fit lambda CDM model and the actual values in the L bins. And a lot of work has been gone in 2015 release to make higher L systematics much cleaner. If you go and flash back to 2013 things, there is a lot of things have been cleaned up there. So, and for polarization thing, you now get the spectrum with beautiful bumps showing. One of the cool thing about them that when you get shown this, for example, TE correlation paper, the red line there is not best fit to TE correlation line. It's the best fit to TT data in the previous plot, essentially. So the fact that you get like almost perfect overlap with polarization data and your temperature only data is a pretty good, you know, indicator that you know your cosmology. Because polarization looks at different things at temperature. Temperature is just gravitational potential. Polarization is essentially has to do with how stuff sloshes around in this gravitational potential. It's like looking on two different sides of an object. From one end it appears a circle, from another end it appears a circle, then it's maybe a sphere, but if it appears as a square, then maybe it's a cylinder. So if you're looking at another channel, you're basically testing your understanding of what the object is you're looking at. So, and this persists in its beauty if you go to EE mode as well. That's once again, the red line is the best fit to TT. And it fits pretty damn well. So there are a few anomalies on the stuff, and I'll get back to them. One of them I will highlight right away. If you look at it, there is some prominent thingy going on around here that's L equal 20. And there is, of course, this, the infamous quadrupole, low quadrupole value. I don't want to know how many papers have been written on that one. In least estimates, like, you know, 100, on biggest estimates, 10,000, I would imagine. How many of them are right, I don't know. But it's fun to play around with anomalies. So of course, what you really want to do is extend this, you know, spectrum and nail B mode spectrum out of it. Planck currently cannot do a clean B mode spectrum and present it in this form. So, what you really want to do is go get not only, well, I'm talking about B mode of the CMB, of course, not the B mode of other stuff. That one you can get. What you really want to go is you want to go after the B mode for the CMB. And there are two components to it, which are fairly easy. One of them is fairly easy to see. The other one is basically very much what you want to see. The easy one to see is the conversion of the E mode polarization pattern to B mode by gravitational lensing. You have a polarization pattern. You just basically squeeze it and stretch it in a few places. You get mode conversion. That one is quite visible. But what you want to go is you want to go for the low L modes in BB, which are primordial gravitational wave. And those guys will tell you what the inflationary scale is right now. It's degenerate with a slow roll parameter, essentially. Now, so it's impossible to talk about this without talking about the BICEP story. You've seen this one, no doubt. Essentially, BICEP and Keck is experiment from looking at the small patch of the sky with really large count of detector array all over again in two channels, 100 and 143, I believe. 100 and 150. Back in 2014, they had the primordial gravitational wave detection paper, which was a little bit more optimistic in its phrasing than it probably should have been. This is how BICEP region looks like if you look at this dust map of the Planck. So Planck is, of course, covering full sky. So you can go and look at the stuff, like how much of the dust emission you have. That's the temperature map, once again, smeared in the direction of polarization. It is fairly clean region, but it's not completely like, you know, dust empty region on the sky. One of the hard things about it is what do you do with dust removal of this thing. Planck has not quite the resolution of BICEP, and the noise is, of course, quite a bit worse because of the number of the detectors involved. But essentially, what you can try to do is you can try to de-dust the maps you get from BICEP by essentially doing cross-correlation between their sky and the dust sky you see from Planck. Now, the critical thing of it, you have to extrapolate the dust map at 100 gigahertz or whatever you're comparing with from 353 map. So you have to Planck down, well, not Planck down, extrapolate the dust amount from the dust map at high frequency to the dust map of the low frequency. This assumes you know what the dust spectrum is. Right now, it's done essentially with a Gaussian prior for a certain spectral tilt and a global one for the sky. So this might not be quite as simple as that. And understanding that physical problem is probably like, you know, what is will need to be done to get the B modes. By the looks of it, there will be no easy way out of that one. Anyway, so looking around to all the possible cross correlations, you essentially probably going to get lost. But the one you want to see is 150-150 cross correlation from BICEP and Keck array. It had this telltale bump at around 70 L, which look like a B mode sticking out for primordial one. Unfortunately, if you subtract out the cross correlated component, and here's the same bump blown up, it goes away on you. One of the things which sort of, you know, rises your eyebrow, if you keep looking at the higher L, you see Lenzing signal, and they had quite a bit more power than the Lenzing spectrum as well in that paper. So for some, like when the paper just went out and I went out looking at it, I thought for a bit that normalization of temperature units is off by factor of, basically like factor of, you know, maybe 60, 50% or something like this. But turn out the story is not quite so easy. There is actually other stuff you're looking at in that map, and it's hard to decorrelate. So.
The blue points are after projecting out a best fit.
Yes. So essentially, the black points are the bicep-keck cross-correlation, and this bicep-keck cross-correlation minus the coefficient we determine bicep-keck cross Planck map, Planck dust map, extrapolated, mind you. So this sort of, you know, does stuff to the likelihood of things. If you just take bicep and keck, the likelihood was not touching zero. If you combine everything, bicep, keck, and Planck, the likelihood is starts touching zero quite prominently, and the best fit value is about 0.005. Now, this is very dependent, or not very dependent, it's very much hinges on the understanding of what the dust map is doing at the frequency. So what has gone in it in the likelihood model, and particularly the dust frequency spectrum and the dust frequency property maps, you're assuming that you know what the dust map is so you can subtract it out. If you don't subtract it out perfectly, you will bias your E mode into the B mode. That is dangerous. You have to worry about understanding what the dust is doing a lot when you do this. In particular, it could be that the spectral index is not quite constant and could vary, for example, spatially. That would induce B mode. So this is not going to be easy, but it's probably going to be fun to figure out. And probably you will not get a primordial cosmology B mode answer until you understand what the dust is doing in the first place. So
how can you understand it? Will many more frequencies help?
So many more frequencies do help, because you get better picture of the dust behavior as the frequency goes.
You still need to assume something.
Yes, you still need to understand what the dust is doing to get the model out of it so you can subtract it out. Now, right now, we cannot even make a super good dust map, which is plausible looking. For example, let's say I want to see how much my likelihood will change if I flunk around different dust skies. Well, we measure just one. We need to get a bunch of the fake ones. How do you do it? It's not a Gaussian random field.
Is bicep 3 going to have more frequencies?
Yes, I think they're going for 220 as well.
So are there forecasts with the bicep 3?
Oh, there is lots of forecasts. Like people do Fisher matrix forecasts all the time. there is an industry of forecasting stuff. But these plans usually encounter sort of difficulties when non-Gaussianities appear.
But the frequency depends, dust versus primordial. It's
fairly significant. You can say it's more difficult. Yep. So, I mean, there is debate going on what to do, what's the best thing. Let me scroll back to the frequency coverage maps. There is the best, like, there are basically, like, you know, a few things. Well, for example, you can actually worry about if your sum of the foregrounds is completely flat and parallel to CMB, you will might not be ever possible to extract it from frequency information about it. People worry about it, you know. So there might be just, you know, that the sum of the all foregrounds around the where you want to look at them is just completely degenerate with CMB, and that would be a sad story. But maybe it's not quite so bad, because even if you have exactly the same frequency behavior, morphology of these maps by like visually looking at them is entirely different. There is entire, like, you know, untapped set of information in you know, in essentially the structure of 2 point, like, you know, 3 point correlators in these maps. So this becomes now sort of, you know, image recognition problem. You're not going after, like, you know, random Gaussian fields anymore. You're going after stuff which has structure in them. And it's actually high signal to noise maps. you know how the dust looks like fairly well. In high intensity regions, you know it perfectly, essentially. It's just it looks complicated. And it is, you know, random and turbulent on small scales. But it has like large scale correlations as well. Can you disentangle them? Yeah, probably. I mean, human eye is very good in disentangling stuff from like, you know, noise. But pipelines have not been written. So maybe this is the future. So anyway, that's the stuff which is interesting to me. I can talk a lot about it. For now, essentially, what stands with the upper bound on likelihood on R is the same thing as from temperature. Temperature only, it's R is less than 0.11, if I remember correctly. It did not change much after looking at this joint likelihood. Now, so, and of course, one of the reasons why you do the CMB in the first place is you want to know what the early universe was like. So in particular, what favorite inflation model is going to appear on the sky, because there are a lot of inflationary models. And this you do by combining all the available data to you and placing constraints. Very often this gets quoted by essentially two parameter plot where you plot the tilt of the primordial scalar fluctuation versus the tensor to scalar ratio. This is sort of a mega uber plot of every inflationary model known to mankind. Condensed down to a few selected ones and overlaid with contours of a few likelihood pipelines. The gray one is 2013, that's barely seen, and the blue one is essentially the tightest one. It's Planck, which uses temperature EE mode and low polarization together. Now, if you throw in bicep kick and baryon acoustic oscillation in there, the contours tighten up quite a bit. They do not actually appear to be shifting that much. They like to sit around at a kind of low tensor to scalar ratio, and a primordial tilt is clearly not one at this point. So, and of course, curiously enough, the very first model of inflation people ever wrote down, the Starobinsky R-squared model, is right smack in the center of it. So take it as you will. It would be the most ultimate irony of, like, you know, the theoretical physicist lifetime if you just, you know, write the first model and then you just get it. Now that would be fun. But of course, like, you know, if you're free to play around with parameter of inflationary models, there is a wide range how far you can end up on this diagram. One of the things I should also point out, because it's near and dear to my heart, is if you notice to it, like all of these inflationary models, even the simple one, like monomial ones, phi square, m square, phi square equation, they have, like, you know, lines on them. What is going on here? It's uncertainty not in the calculating abilities of theoretical physicists. It's like, it's not that I cannot calculate the spectrum in m square, phi square, or I can and sort of like came out from here to here. No, it's not that. It's people don't know how universe reheated after inflation. If you have a known equation of state, you have ambiguity between figuring out how much of number of inflation e-folds modes are exiting at. And that's uncertainty is basically something like 5 to 10 e-folds. So that's what's different between these two things. Since you don't know how you reheated, it is basically not quite clear at what wavelengths you're looking at. And that gives you slightly different distance to the end of the inflation. And that gives you slightly different tilt of the potential because you're slightly off, like, you know, either a little bit higher up or higher down or lower down. Anyway, the data is now so good that you don't have to do, like, you know, monomial model fits anymore. You can just get a free function in your potential or power spectrum and reconstruct it. The data is good enough to nail it in fairly wide range of K. So what I'm going to show you is reconstruction of the primordial spectrum done by our group, Dick Bond, Ji Chi, Huang, and me. And this is, by the way, the longest written paper I've been on. We started doing this stuff back when I was in CETA. That was 2000. The paper came out in 2015. This is like 15 years in the making. I think it has been, like, you know, handed down to like generations of graduate students who became postdocs and now faculty, and now this is finally out. So I am very bad at procrastinating, and I somehow tend to work with people who are also quite good at procrastinating. So anyway.
Is this a null reconstruction? You have those deltas there?
So deltas are where the nodes of the spline is. That's basically 12-node cubic spline with three amplitudes at the node positions. It's not a power law. It's not. It's a free function essentially.
Yeah.
So and you can vary the number of the spline nodes from 7 to like you know a very large number, and it basically gets nailed from here to here. It's just this is assuming free R, free like scalar to tensor ratio and temperature data only. You throw more stuff and it becomes more nailed. One of the things you notice that it wants to sort of, you know, fluctuate up and down in high things, it's just noise talking, but it also wants to systematically bend over and get this dip around L equal 20. That's not noise talking, that's that dip on the spectrum.
What exactly is on the y-axis?
Oh, it's a power spectral thing. So it's a primordial spectrum multiplied by k cube. If you have a scale invariant spectrum, it would be straight line horizontal. If you have something like m squared phi squared, that's the black one, would be it.
So it's not noise, but what would be the, if you showed, somehow, what's the cosmic variance down there? Is that dip significant compared to cosmic variance, or no?
So cosmic variance is not that large on 20. So you basically have like, you know, quite a few multiples to average on it. So what is done here is essentially you have the full range of splines which went through the MCMC chains to see how likely they are comparing to the data. There's been a lot of them on this. So that tells you how much floppiness you have in it. So essentially the spread which is admissible by the data is like, you know, one sigma and two sigma is this like, you know, black bands.
Can I ask the extrema of your mean P of R seems to coincide with the spline points indicated at the bottom, suggesting that your methodology has some kind of bias to place the extrema there. Could you comment on that?
Wait. This is not mean.
I'm looking on the left-hand side particularly.
Oh, left-hand side, yeah. But it won't be...
True on the left-hand side would be true, but less visible elsewhere. My question is, does your scheme bias you to have extrema at the location of the spline?
So this is a natural boundary condition on the spline, so the left, the end is free to flop. And I'm not sure that this is a biasing effect. You do worry about the endpoints being doing something strange about it, but this is mostly, I think, caused not by bias of the endpoint, but rather the structure of the L equal 20 sort of thing getting pushed on you. So that starts bendy, and then it starts bendy, being bendy. Because of that.
Try the reconstruction where the spline points are displaced to be intermediate between the ones in this reconstruction?
Yep. And it's been done with different number of nodes. And there's been two different other methods of reconstruction of the potential, one of them on Bayesian node positions, whatever that is. So anyway, they all come up with the same sort of, you know, picture. So this is an inflation paper. Pull it up. There is like, you know, three different potential reconstruction methods. So you throw, where was I? You throw more constraints at it, you basically tighten up the data. So here it is, if you assume that you know what R is, it will tighten up the data. If you throw slightly different R at it, it will once again tighten up the data, but give you different low end power. Because if you say R is now bigger, then the scalar power will be less at that end, so, which it is. Not dramatically, but you notice it. And remarkably enough, not only temperature data, but just TE correlation data nails the primordial power spectrum. Just TE correlation data, if you like put a spline in it, it nails you in essentially to scale invariant thing in fairly large range of K. That's actually pretty amazing that the data is so good now.
This part makes it seem like you can see NS being different from one in TE above K. Is that true?
Come again?
Well, the visual tilt here suggests that you can see NS being different from 1 and TE alone.
There is, so black line is definitely tilted. There is absolutely no question about it. It's the one which fiducial model is probably m-squared phi squared on this plot. It is definitely an S not equal to 1. So if it was 1, it would go from here to essentially here. It's just the tilt is small. So you're looking at, like, you know, these waves you're looking at are bigger than the tilt.
With the power law, because we only ever look at NS plots derived from the
Nautri
construction. Well,
I'm not sure what you would call an average NS of a Wiggly line. You might come up with some sort of, you know, weighted average of it.
What would I call an average NS? I guess if there was a method to extract what is the average tilt of a line, is the best fit in this spline method.
Well, here's one way of to extract it.
Something very different from the NS numbers we usually take, and that's noteworthy.
Here, one method, chord slope. Take one endpoint, take another endpoint, subtract it, divide it by the point
and
between them.
That's your fiducial model
there. No, the red one is not fiducial model.
Oh, I see. So what is the number you get for that?
So it's the same as fiducial model, as you can clearly see, because it basically sits at the same endpoints. So it's basically the same 0.960-ish sort of tilt. Yeah. So in fact, like, you know, this story about running spectral index is most likely going to go away, because even if you allow running of the spectral index, it doesn't want to fit the data. It just, if it doesn't improve. Hold on a few slides. I'll show you. So anyway, even if you do EE mode, you still get nailed in the power spectrum determination. So that alone, like just polarization data alone, no temperature whatsoever, nails you to the scale invariant spectrum in some range of k. That is pretty amazing as well. Of course, the noise is worse because you're looking just at polarization. Anyway, and you keep throwing stuff and throwing stuff. You throw everything you've got at it, including Bicep and Keck, and it is pretty scale invariant, apart from that wavy features in the, at the end, at the low L end. So what is it anyway? So let's zoom in. Now I abandoned this, you know, showing stuff as averages with the bands picture. But here is essentially the graph where you zoom in from L of basically a few to 100 here. And you have fiducial model once again done by essentially a straight line. The thin black line is just an axis. But if you want to assume something like a breaking power law or funny things happening with optical depth, it will distort your line. But what it does, it just bends it ever so slightly in this direction. So it does not want to reproduce this feature where you get in, like, you know, a lot of reconstructed trajectories around L equal 20. And if you plot the raw, like, you know, spectrum data, you know why. These guys, they all go down here. So it looks like they conspire to get, like, you know, something going low in power. And it just pushes on the reconstruction. So it is real. It's in the spectrum. It is some sort of, you know, large, bulky displacement at around L equal 20. And it's not localized. You wouldn't believe how much time we spent on, like, you know, trying to cut out parts of the sky and find, like, you know, the place which is causing this. No, it's not localized. So you can, like, cut out any sort of suspicious anomaly you care about. It's not going away. You can start cutting out random pieces of sky, like, you know, just, and it's like, do it, and it's not going away. So you can try in painting random pieces of sky by, like, you know, Gaussian random field realization with the correct spectrum. It's still not going away. So it is on the sky.
Is it in WMAP?
Yeah.
What is the statistical script?
Statistical significance of it is not that high. It's just a couple of sigma. So it's barely, like, it's basically two sigma. So it's nothing that, like, you would be, like, you know, crying, I detected something awesome, which is supposedly five sigma. But it also does give you some sort of, you know, train of thought why, how such a thing would happen. If you're a theoretical physicist, you probably, like, you know, are stimulated by this. Yes?
Information has one particular single field ratio of R to tips of top.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But could.
When are we ever going to measure the tips of top?
Ah, tensor tilt. Nice. Let's get it. Well, wouldn't it be nice? It's actually going to be really hard to measure because you don't get to see B modes for a large pivot in K. So taking derivative of that is going to be bloody hard. But would be nice. Maybe. Maybe if like you understand lensing potential completely and you can completely remove it and you can get to that other end of it. But it's going to be hard. Well, if the simple model of inflation works with all the like you know parameters that I have, I'm fairly happy to call it like what does it call? Functionally cured model of inflation. I guess I am kind of pushing my luck here, and I still want to talk a little bit about anomalies. But one of the last things I should notice that should note when I talk about inflation is that because of this constrictive power of the data, it is now entirely possible to reconstruct the potential of the scalar field, assuming it's a single scalar field inflation. It might be doing something. This, of course, is degenerate with a slow roll parameter. So if you don't assume anything about the R, you get a bunch of straight lines, but of different tilt. So essentially, this is normalized, so end of inflation is, well, not end of inflation. There is a certain pivot point where you are actually looking at, I think it's basically corresponds to a normalization point in the power, basically where you put the pivot for the fluctuations. Anyway, so you're looking at the things, and here's the picture of the potential reconstructed to you. And if you let R do what you want, you end up going to fairly steep potentials. And if you fix R, you end up on the flatter potentials. Now, the most entertaining thing is, of course, is if you constrain the R by having a bicep keg data thrown at it. And then it wants to do this, essentially. It looks like a chunk of a line with some spread and tilts. That corresponds essentially to the freedom in R you have from those likelihoods. All right. So now, in the remaining 5 minutes, I will do a crash course on anomalies, and there is a lot more stuff to it. One of the obvious things that people have talked about is north-south anomaly. If you look at the north and south part of the sky, and north and south are nominal one, there is just, you know, you just cut it in this direction. The RMS of fluctuations in the C-maps appear to be different. This is slightly tricky problem because RMS of stuff is dangerous. It's biased, right? So you have to subtract out your zero base point and figure out how much of excursion you have. What you're looking at here is one of the plots from Isotropy Statistics paper where you take RMS of fluctuations inside the disk. You subtract the mean of the set fluctuations in all the simulations of the CMB you have. And you inverse variance weighted and essentially plot the probability percentile to get this thing. So essentially, you have a lot more blue stuff in this hemisphere compared to a lot of red in this hemisphere. So this appears to be some sort of difference in power in 8-degree disks between the sky. Now, this has been talked about a lot. So direction of this. No, the black line is not ecliptic. That's a cut in the direction of that preferred dipole. And that direction comes in taking a variance map and fitting the dipole to it. So that direction actually depends on what you do to this. So it is basically where they point up in different sort of, you know, different cuts. And essentially it points in the variance dipole amplitude is something like 5% and points roughly in the southern direction of the sky, not quite as low as the cold spot, which is here. And it wanders around a little bit depending on what the cuts you place around. CMB dipole is pointing that direction. And ecliptic is actually kind of like that as well. But since it wanders around so much, it's hard to tell, like pinpoint on like to what it is actually pointing. You can do a little bit fancier statistics with this if you care to. If you actually have dipole asymmetry in the primordial spectrum, then you're coupling modes in your spectrum. You have dipole modulation, you're multiplying a dipole YLM with all the other YLMs. You do the decomposition, you get LL plus one coupling. So if you go to cross correlation matrices, you can go for off diagonal element, not CLL, but essentially LL plus one correlation. And that should be non-zero if you go out and have a dipole modulation. So here is a plot, once again, with the probability value to exceed stuff from simulation versus the cut of the L maximal modes compared to the sims. It does, this is percent, not normalized to one. So it does hit a 1% likelihood or unlikelihood value in a few places. Now, where is this coming at? This is actually disappears in a few places. So if you are lucky enough to choose your L max in this analysis to be 10, it goes away on you. If you're lucky enough to choose it like to be like basically 40, it's actually quite prominent on you. So there is a lot of discussion, even internally, which is like, how do you assign significance to this? Looks elsewhere effect and whatnot have been topics of discussion ad infinitum of the telecoms.
We did the same analysis in WMAP. Yeah. What we did there is just ask, what's the probability that a random Monte Carlo simulation dips as low as the data?
Yep.
And we assigned a probability of order 10%.
Yeah. So, but again, this value is basically depends on where you put the, it depends on the filter you, like, you know, throw at the data, right? So.
Yeah, it's not completely free of choices, like if you decide what LMAX is.
Yeah. Curiously enough, one of the things is that if you remove all the modes below L100 and reduce the things, it goes away. So it looks like that dipole anomaly is basically essentially riding around on stuff which is like, you know, low L, relatively low L in the data. So if you basically high pass it, high pass frequency stuff is not highly dipole modulated essentially. So that might tell you and might not tell you something. Four different pipelines. So that's one of the things, like, you know, in isotropy statistics paper, we went over all the four pipelines with all the simulations through all four pipelines. Therefore, it was a lot of computer time burned. And it's encouraging to see that they're actually not dramatically different. Otherwise, if they were like completely different, I would not believe any of that anomaly stuff. That would be just foreground things. If you get the same things for the different foreground removing methods, you just reasonably feel warm and fuzzy about like that you're looking at the CMB map, not some other stuff. Anyway, my favorite topics in all of this is localized anomalies, not the ones which are buried in like Fourier spectrum, like FNL stuff, would be non-Gaussian. But something which happens here, or like or there, like on early universe, and it has local effect on the sky and does something. For example, like, you know, there is was some sort of, you know, interesting event, and then you ended up with one place on the sky which is different from the other places on the sky. How do you go out for this? Well, if you have a model of that interesting stuff, you do much filtering, you do Wiener filters for stuff. You don't have a model, but what you can do stuff, you can just go, basically go and look for things which exceed your expectations. The best thing I like is essentially go after peaks. Peaks are high signal to noise regions in the CMB, and if you smooth the CMB, peaks extract most of the information in the essentially smooth map. So, and it's very easy to visualize and do statistics on. So here's my SMICA map. One of the first things you do with this is you basically want to get rid of the CMB power, which is different than different L's. So if you want to do statistical, optimal statistical estimation, you basically want to have your background, which is CMB, have constant power. Then that is basically will normalize the signal, which is now non-Gaussian stuff, which I'm looking at. So the very first thing you do with this map is you whiten it. When you whiten it, you notice that the galactic thing is actually quite prominent in it, and there is a lot of other point sources you might be worried about. Then you mask it with a mask substantially grown to get rid of the stuff which you probably don't want to talk about. Then you smear it with a filter of your choice. Usually it's a peak detector filter. It could be as simple as Gaussian. I like Savitsky-Galay polynomials, which are essentially this orthogonal polynomials on the disk. People use them in chemistry for spectral peak detection all the time. It's probably the top cited chemistry paper of all times. And essentially what you get is you get a smooth sky with a bunch of cold and hot spots. There could be like large number of them, depends on the scale at which you filter. And you can extract information about it by essentially just looking at the hot and cold spots. So visually, if you...
So the top cited chemistry paper of all time is cited because they use it for what?
So spectral line detection. You get a spectroscopy, you get a noisy stuff with lines sticking out. How do you get the line position heights? So you filter it with exactly the filter which looks for peak detection. So I shamelessly stole that filter and adopted it to the not linear, but you know, the spherical sky, and I like it. Anyway, in case you basically wonder what these things are, I can show you the thing. They're basically sort of, you know, slightly optimized brick pass filters. So they pull in higher L modes, but they don't oscillate up and down, and they're localized in space. They're kind of like wavelets. So anyway, you get those peaks out, and visually, like, you know, they correspond to the morphology of the map very well. And you can do statistics on them, because statistics of the peak distribution of the Gaussian random field in two dimensions is known. That's Bond and Estacio paper of a long time ago. It is not a Gaussian, because these things are peaks, but it is basically has a Gaussian function and an error function in it. So if you think that these red points are the distribution, CDF, commutative density function, extracted from the data, that's extremely easy to extract. You just get the peak heights. Peaks are the pixels which are hotter than anything around them, or colder than anything around them. Then you get their value and you sort them. You get cumulative density function. Sorting is rank statistics, it's unbiased, so it's actually very nice. It's better than binning stuff. But anyway, if you look at it and you say, well, here's my distribution, how does it compare to that formula? Well, that's how it compares to the fit. Essentially, it fits exceedingly well, so by eye you do not see any differences. And in fact, if you do Kolmogorov-Smirnov test, which is basically look for the maximal deviation between the best fit and the actual Z thingy, it looks like this. And one of the things you might want to do slightly better is not assign constant cuts for Kolmogorov-Smirnov, because these things are correlated. This is a random field. It's not identically independent distributed, you know, numbers. But you can easily get the bounds on the deviation, a Kolmogorov-Smirnov deviation, from just running a bunch of sims. And that's what the bounds are. They're not quite constant, but essentially all the points look between 1 sigma and 2 sigma, that I think. So things appear to be as Gaussian as ever, but there is a fly in the ointment. You can filter the map at different scales, and you go filter, 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 and then you end up with this, and you go and like say, what this is this? It's actually so high that it clipped. It's completely like black in this thing. So. And then it goes away on you on larger scales. So what is it? Well, it triggers something, and if you look at the probability values of these things, it goes to below 1%, essentially. And that is no matter what it is, but what filtering sort of, you know, thing you do, it still is here. It's not the only thing that's here. There is other guys at different scales which appear to you then. Kind of anomalous, but not nearly as anomalous. But this guy is a cold spot, the infamous cold spot. So.
So it's what, 1% without applying any look elsewhere correction?
So there is actually essentially almost no look elsewhere correction, because I have a lot of points here, but they're super correlated. Because the filters, if you look at different scales, they're essentially completely correlated until you change the scale by a factor of 2 or 3. So there is no look elsewhere, there is like 3 points on this graph. Which basically what it looks like. There is like one regular curve, another regular curve, another regular curve. The reason why you get like, you know, these sharp crossovers is because you look at the coldest one. So there is basically was one trigger, another trigger, another trigger, and you get just the maximum. So.
I mean, I could certainly imagine there are 5 independent points, which is all you need to make it less than 2 sigma.
As I said, you can actually assign a likelihood to this, like with all like full sweep in it. You can do cross correlation matrix of all of these things. It does not degrade your significance that much, because essentially there is only 3 independent points being thrown at this. So roughly, like, you know, if you go to the probability value, you basically, that's what roughly what you're going to do if you do the full more generalization. A little bit worse, but not dramatically. And these are not the optimal filters you can do if you allow yourself to tweak things. For example, I can subtract the mean from one, like from my things, they will go down, like, you know, here.
I mean, that's just turning knobs to maximize the significance. I mean, optimal in the sense that you get the largest value on the data. There's no prediction to optimize against.
Well, it depends. Like, if you allow to the shape to vary, maybe you're turning knobs. If you allow constant to vary, you're just subtracting out the RMS of a noisy operator. So I don't want to go into this marginalization story. It is boring and long, and you will be debating between like 2.1 sigma and 1.9 sigma. So maybe no. So, the reason why you suspect that something is wrong with the sky, or maybe our understanding of the stuff, is basically if you look at the distribution of the peaks, most of the peaks on the sky, peaks like peaks, they like happily live between, well, there is 64 of them. They live between basically 2.5 sigma to basically 2.5 sigma, filling in the distribution. Kolmogorov-Sperov deviation is fine, but there is this guy, which is like 50% colder than anything else on the sky at these filtering scales. So it is different. You can like, you know, do statistics to justify how different it is. It's different. It might be a good idea to look at it, what it is. So this is what it looks like on the sky if you actually center as a map on it and you do not apply any smoothing filters on it. So it is a bunch of cold peaks all clustered together. It has a shape associated with this. It has morphology. It looks like lambda. It might be branded for half-life. You know, that's like ultimate sort of advertising. You get your name imprinted on the CMB maps for the next universe to come around. So one of the ways you can do, because we're now talking about stuff which is likely to be non-Gaussian and strange, you can try to take a look at morphology. If you don't know anything else about the process, you might as well to figure out how it looks like and count things which are morphological. And the way you do it, you can actually see where the peaks are at different filtering scales and see how they go around and change the filtering scale. That's like a merger tree for galaxy formation. You trace small stuff, big stuff, see how they move. Now, CMB has no process like that associated with this physical process like that. You can still do morphology like that. So here's what you do get if you filter sky on the different scales, put these peak positions in there, and I indicate every single peak here by a dot of varying size is a filter scale, and see how the things wander around on the sky. This has been done on Witten map. CMB peaks should just wander around randomly on the filtering scale. They have no correlation, essentially. This guy doesn't want to wander around randomly. It does want to sit around here and sort of, you know, pulls in three peaks coming together.
Wait, so what's plot here is the location of the global minimum as the filtering scales vary?
Is this location of basically minimal or minima, local ones, as the scale is varied. It is multi-scale representation of what the sky is looking like. In fact, the next one I'm going to show you is going to be even more busy because you're going to see all the peaks on all the sky, so on all the scales of filtering. And you can rank order them in temperature, and you can do connectedness graphs on them based on their essentially evolution, and you get the essentially tree associated with them. That blue lines you have, like, you know, coming in, is the ones which have been connected to the coldest peak on the sky at some point in their life. So this is actually a graph of things. It's like, you know, how you connect things. It has all kinds sort of connectedness measures you can do statistics on. So for fun, here's how the statistics of connectedness of nodes on that linkage tree looks like, depending on the node degree. And that's one of the simplest morphology you can do on a graph. And the red bands is what's on the sky. The blue bands are essentially the distributions from simulations in it. Now, as you can see, the CMB sky is actually quite agreeable in all of the node counting things with the simulations and stuff. But if I would throw this, merger tree analysis on the dust, you'd get these points. And it is entirely possible and super obvious to see that, like, you know, just by doing this, that the dust sky is morphologically different from CMB. Now, this does not appear like a very large thingy, but it's huge, huge, statistical significance. Statistical significance in it. So these maps are entirely like, you know, different morphologically. You can easily nail it. And the peaks are also repeat the story of the two hemispheres being different. You can extract peaks from one side, you can extract peaks from another side of the sky, and the distributions are different. So this starts looking substantially like, you know, 3 sigma different now if you do this. I didn't marginalize over directions, I just took the directions from the dipole analysis. Took 1/3 of the sky that way, 1/3 of the sky that way. Two distributions are different. They do not pass Komarov-Smirnov test. Okay, so I'll skip the stacking story. There is lots of ways to stack. The other one last thing I will say is the stacking is actually sort of, you know, what is probably critical to understand what the correlations are like on the sky. So if you're going after long non-Gaussian structures which have long correlation lengths, when you stack them and you orient them in the preferred direction of that structure, you're going to have your non-Gaussian signal added up. Your CMB signal will have your CMB signal pattern. So here are two stacks. On the left, you see CMB polarization, which is oriented in the polarization direction, or something like a temperature ellipticity of the peak direction. And on the right-hand side, you have a dust map stacked, for starting from not bright regions to brighter and brighter regions. So let me increase the brightness of this thing. So I'll go for very bright things. And that's the brightest one. And one of the things you have to realize, the correlation length of CMB is basically like, you know, about 1 degree in radius. This guy is like, you know, 15 degrees across. This is huge correlation length. So the dust looks extremely different in stacks. And if you are after it, and you can come up with a point process which will extract this correlation pattern. And once you know the correlation pattern, you can use it to try to figure out with the stuff just morphologically. If it has long correlation lengths in one direction, it's most likely dust in the map. So maybe there is something to be done with component separation when you go after it. But for now, the goal is to statistically understand the properties of the dust maps. It's clearly they have like filamentary-like structures, which look like that they have large polarization powers. But statistics of it is interesting and not known. One of the things which is reported is that if you do EB decomposition of the bright filaments, it looks like E to B power is 2 or thereabouts. And it looks like a simple, you know, enough number to be like, you know, explained by theory of the stuff going on. But then again, we don't have understanding of it for now. So I'll stop here. I'll flash in the conclusion slide. But essentially, there is a lot of interesting stuff going to happen in the next few years. Polarization is up and running, and understanding astrophysics is probably going to be fun. Thank you.
So there's been I'm curious to hear your take on, there's been a lot of discussion about whether there's tension between quantum parameters and other experiments, like all measurement of H-naught or low-pitch measurements of sigma 8. It seems like it's getting large enough to be interesting to me, although not conclusive. What's your take on?
I mean, there are quite a few things people worry about. One of them is, for example, that parameters of the feed wander around when you slide the cutoffs on Lmax, for example. That itself is probably not super worrisome, because if you throw more data at the feed, you constrain it, so you push on it, and you would be kind of lucky if they, like, you know, you get exactly the same best feed value. Is like, let's say, quarter of your data, that's the full, you know, resolution thing. So the fact that parameters wander a little bit is maybe would have been worrisome if they were changing a lot. They appear to be wandering quite a bit less than a sigma value. So once again, you can probably debate how unlikely that is, but I'm not losing too much sleep over it at the moment.
Are H naught and sigma 8 the two most discrepant parameters? H naught between supernovae and
There is some tension as IH node. I don't remember the sigma 8 story. There is also tau, which has been being pushed lower and lower. That is the most interesting to me. So it is being successfully getting pushed lower and lower and lower. It's like 0.055 now, I think. So this actually, that for a change relieves the tension between reionization and the optical depth.
If there are no more questions, let's take Andrea.